Elsewhere today, we're reporting on Screen Free Week, an effort to encourage kids to get some exercise, among other things. Now we hear of people getting off the couch and out of the living room for a video game. It's a modern take on an ancient sport, jousting. Here's NPR's medieval correspondent, Travis Larchuk.
It's called Johann Sebastian Joust.
Get ready to joust. Go!
The first notable thing about this game is it's not tethered to a TV screen, so players can take the action outside, which is exactly what these people are doing at a video game conference in Los Angeles.
I'm telling Mom!
Instead of staring at a screen, the players are looking at each other. And off to the side, a portable speaker plays Johann Sebastian Bach's Brandenburg Concertos. Four people nervously stalk each other. Each holds a PlayStation Move controller. It kind of looks like a microphone, with a glowing orb on top, lit up in pink or yellow or blue. Although the game's called Johann Sebastian Joust, the object is to keep your controller away from the other players. And you have to keep tempo with the music, which changes. If it speeds up, you speed up.
Thank you for noting.
If it slows down, you slow down. If you ever move faster than the music, like, say, if another player pushes you, the controller senses it, and you're out.
And the winner is yellow player.
In public, it creates a spectacle. Strangers join in, like 17-year-old Zach Wilson.
This is a game I just found out about. It's really invigorating. I'm gonna get you.
Though Johann Sebastian Joust relies on video game hardware to work, it maybe isn't even really a video game.
It's half playground game and like half a video game, but it's this, you know, interesting intersection between those.
That's Douglas Wilson, no relation to Zach. He invented Johann Sebastian Joust. Motion-controlled games aren't new, think of the Nintendo Wii and the Xbox Kinect, but Wilson wanted to take the attention away from graphics on TV.
It's also really fun to see the facial expressions of your friends and to no longer be so tethered to this, you know, strange screen.
Go for the elbow. Go for the elbow.
Go for the knees.
And this game is physical. You're encouraged to chase or push your fellow players. Jesse Schell's a professor at Carnegie Mellon University's Entertainment Technology Center.
Video games that involve touching other people, like when that just doesn't happen, right? Video games are usually so much about just interacting directly with a virtual world.
And that presents a challenge to the game's creator, Douglas Wilson, selling a video game without video.
It becomes this question like, okay, well, will this thing sell? Will people understand it?
So he did what many indie game makers are doing these days, and he crowdfunded the project on Kickstarter. And instead of risking going alone, he teamed up with other indie designers to put Johann Sebastian Joust into a compilation of more arcade-style games. It's called Sports Friends, and after months of delays, it hit the PlayStation Store this week. Jesse Schell says while Johann Sebastian Joust may seem like a novelty or a gimmick, there's actually more to it than that.
This game is the tip of a much larger iceberg that is kind of coming our way. I do think we're going to see a lot of growth in the notion of games without screens or games that are designed to be played outdoors.
Schell says, paradoxically, technology has improved to the point where now it's helping people play games the way they did before computers came along in the first place, face to face. Travis Larchuk, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Eating a bowl of cereal in the morning seems like a simple activity, but it's close to impossible for some of the 1 million Americans who struggle with the tremors of Parkinson's disease. There are also as many as 10 million Americans who suffer from a disorder called essential tremor, which is sometimes mistaken for Parkinson's. Well, now a California engineer has invented an eating utensil that cancels out the uncontrollable shaking. NPR's Ina Jaffe reports.
Joe Bremhorst sits at a large table doing something that most people take for granted. But a severe essential tremor makes eating a bowl of Cheerios nearly impossible.
So we're demonstrating now, obviously, the difficulty I have eating.
You're not getting anything out of that bowl.
Nothing.
Just kind of moving the spoon around.
Yeah, and the closer I get to my mouth, the worse the tremor gets.
This is the problem that engineer Anupam Patek wanted to solve. He can't cure Bremhorst's tremor. Instead, he developed a spoon he calls liftware.
So you can kind of feel it gently vibrating.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the actuators inside.
I'm holding the chunky handle of the spoon at the San Francisco office of Patek's company Lift Labs. As he says, the handle of the spoon vibrates slightly. There's no on-off switch. The device starts automatically when you pick it up.
And so right now it's kind of sensing your motion and it will respond.
It responds by moving the spoon that snaps onto the handle.
There's a little motion sensor right near the spoon. So if I had tremor, it's going to move opposite to what the shaking is doing. So if I move to the left, it will physically move the spoon to the right.
Essentially canceling out the impact of the tremor as the spoon moves from plate to mouth. According to a clinical trial, a liftware spoon cancels out more than 70% of a user's tremor.
And I don't think it took us 5 minutes to say, this is remarkable.
Sheila Garner oversees a couple of dozen senior and assisted living complexes in Northern California. She was impressed enough with the liftware demonstration to order some for her residents with essential tremor.
And certainly we will be able to free up staff time from assisting people with eating, but really our focus is on the fact that this provides a level of dignity for residents with essential tremors that they haven't been able to have because there isn't a utensil that would help them in being able to eat unassisted.
Stabilizing technology has been around for a while. You may have heard of the Steadicam used to shoot movies. But the liftware device has to compensate for larger movements and still fit comfortably in the hand. Patek says he got the idea while he was still in grad school.
And I was working on technologies for the Army Research Lab, and we were working on ways to stabilize equipment for soldiers put into combat.
By equipment, he means guns. But that wasn't what really moved him.
I've always had this sort of drive of wanting to make technologies with this sort of very personal and immediate impact.
An impact which you can see when Joe Bremhorst attacks that bowl of Cheerios with the liftware spoon.
Well, these Cheerios are good on you, Pop.
He doesn't drop a single one. Bremhorst is part of an essential tremor support group that tested prototypes of the liftware spoon. While he now has a brain implant that can control his tremor, he shut it off to participate in the tests. At first, the device was a clunky thing with wires sticking out and a plastic picnic spoon taped to the end. Sharon Alexander, the facilitator of the support group, says members gave Patek a lot of feedback.
They all had opinions, and he would be scribbling them down. And yeah, this is where we are today. This has been phenomenal for us.
The product just became available commercially last December, and it's not cheap. Almost $300. Patek doesn't disclose exactly how many he sold. Let's just say more than 1,000. Medicare and private insurance don't pay for the devices yet, but a handful of VA medical centers do. Meanwhile, Patek's raised enough money on the internet and through foundations to give away a couple of hundred spoons to people who can't afford them. And soon there will be new attachments. A fork and a soup spoon should be available next month. On the drawing board are devices for holding a door key steady and grabbing small objects.
We want it to be kind of like a Swiss Army knife, so it's not just for a spoon, it's for a whole bunch of other things.
Which could stabilize the lives and maintain the independence of a lot of people with essential tremor and Parkinson's disease. Ina Jaffe, NPR News.
Okay, maybe you've had this moment. You're trying to recall the lyrics to a song. You know the first line, can't remember the second line. Trailer for Sailor Rent. And then what? So you go to Google for help. Many websites will serve up those words to you, and many feature advertising. Sometimes the lyrics on those sites appear without the songwriter's permission. NPR's Zoe Chase has the story of one songwriter who decided to fight back.
The songwriter, David Lowry. The song, he sang it for me.
Hey, 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 like being stoned.
A hit for his band, Cracker. He also wrote this.
Let's see if I get the right key here. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling.
Lowry sold albums, toured the country, all pretty lucrative. But Lowry remembers when he first started to think about the value of the words to his songs, the words alone. He was touring in late 2002, and he decided to play this one song, Kerosene Hat. But there was a problem. He couldn't remember the lyrics.
It's actually hard to remember the lyrics to all the songs, especially if you haven't played them in a long time.
He had to Google his own song, and he found all these websites, some of them with advertising, making money. He assumed money he thought that should be his.
I wrote those lyrics. I came up with those lyrics, and I put the words together in such a way that people found them valuable and they wanted those words.
David Lowery fumed over this for the last decade, trying to figure out how to go after these websites.
We've evolved these parasitic middlemen who extract value that rightfully should go to the songwriter.
And recently, he came up with a way to strike back: public shaming. After much Googling, he came up with a list of 50 websites that were not paying artists.
Undesirable lyric website list.
Showed it to David Israelite, the head of a music publisher's trade group, who decided to hold this press conference, announcing they'd be sending out 50 takedown notices to the 50 sites on the list. And public enemy number one?
Rap Genius. Yes, Rap Genius is on this list. In fact, I believe it's number one.
That's number one.
Rap Genius, one of the top song lyric websites. The guys who run it, they heard this threat and they were kind of amused.
My name's Elon. I'm 25 years old. I am 30. And we are at the Rap Genius office, which is in Williamsburg in Brooklyn. Tom's here. He's chilling.
Hello.
Elon hands me a bottled water. The label says Baller Water. There's a big neon diamond on the wall, a deck in the back. Rap Genius says they don't belong on the list of undesirable websites. We're not stealing lyrics, they say. We are enhancing them. Here's what Rap Genius does. Say I'm listening to this Kanye song, Mercy.
Well, if it's my way, it's been on the morning, then I'm not doing this.
Got it?
If it's my way, it's been on the morning, then I'm not doing this.
Well, if you go to Rap Genius's site and type in the song Mercy, the lyrics come up. Turns out it is a weeping and a moaning and a gnashing of teeth. Then if you click on those lyrics, a little window pops up with an explanation. It's a biblical reference.
This verse describes the plight of those who will be sent to hell. Kanye is implying that his presence in the game brings hell to other rappers.
Rap Genius has become immensely popular. They don't have ads on their site, but they do have $15 million of Silicon Valley investment capital. And Elon, the Rap Genius guy, says the artists love his site. He says what they've created is something brand new. All the commentary, the exegesis, even some of the rappers themselves comment on their own lyrics.
Nobody has said to you, oh, you're stealing those are mine.
David Lowery.
David Lowery, the songwriter from Cracker. It was like the battle of the bands. Cracker versus Rap Genius, songwriter versus website. The battle of the bands could have been decided in a courtroom. But the music industry is scary, and lawyers and lawsuits are expensive. So just this week, Rap Genius announced it's licensed up. It's going to pay the publishers, the songwriters, including David Lowery, who says that other lyric sites have also been caving and getting licensed. And now the checks are rolling in every time someone looks up the words, hey, 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 like being stoned. So now he knows just what those words are worth.
Lyric websites are not a big revenue source for me. It would be in the high hundreds a year. I'm a hundredaire.
Less than $1,000 a year?
I think probably less than $1,000 in my case.
So not much. But this is a rare case where the internet comes along and figures out a brand new way for musicians to make money. Not off the music, just the words alone. Zoe Chase, NPR News.
Let's shift now to the digital world and report on the kind of moving picture called a GIF or GIF. Dictionaries accept either pronunciation, and by either pronunciation, the Museum of the Moving Image in Queens, New York, is giving the GIF its own show. NPR's Netta Ulaby paid a visit.
Maybe the least interesting thing about the GIF, G-I-F, is what it stands for, Graphic Interchange Format. A GIF is a little box showing a loop of someone doing something over and over. Museum-goer Abby Cox sees them used as comments on Facebook, Tumblr, and Reddit.
They're gestures that are sort of hard to put into words.
Like Oprah shaking her head in a way that says unmistakably, uh-uh, uh-uh-uh. Or a gif of a saucer-eyed baby freaking out over a toy can show you're startled or thrilled or both.
It's all about context, and that's why I think this is a great exhibit.
The exhibit is 37 little gifs projected by the museum's stark white entrance. They're reactions used to respond to other people's posts. So the gif of actress Jennifer Lawrence giving side-eye and a sarcastic thumbs-up means...
Yeah, okay, sure.
For most of human history, we've communicated face-to-face.
That's the curator of this exhibition. Jason Epink is a lanky 30-year-old in a plaid blazer and T-shirt. He says gifs can be jumping animals or angry sports fans. But gifs of actors bring multiple layers of meaning because we associate them with their characters. Take a gif of Larry David as an erotic writer on his TV show, Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Furrowed brow, it's like he's sort of shaking his head in a way, like he's like weighing both sides. It's so complex and so nuanced.
And so economical. The clip is 5 seconds long.
You could have seen the gif loop 10 times already in the time it took me to like explain that.
Epink asked users of the website Reddit to submit gifs and explain how they're used. Those explanations are captions in the exhibit, so when you see the gif of Larry David shaking his head, it's clear what someone means when they post it.
I value your argument and want to agree with you, but...
Yeah, but I'm not prepared for the consequences of doing so.
Gladys Flores is at the museum with her daughter. Until now, she'd never even seen a gif.
I'm not really into computer.
While the expressions and gestures in gifs are not necessarily universal, gifs have become integral to the internet vernacular. Julia Flores hangs out on comment boards, and she uses GIFs.
All the time when I try to express stuff. I always use Paul Rudd dancing, because that's the best way to express happiness.
There's not really a word in English that sums up the uninhibited charm of actor Paul Rudd dancing. GIFs stand for feelings it would take too many words to express. And they show how you can boil down the vast sea of popular culture into one supremely personal little drop. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Now, the digital revolution means there are more ways than ever to read, and yet a new survey finds the number of American teens reading for pleasure has dropped dramatically. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
For sure, Harry Potter and the Hunger Games haven't been big hits for nothing. Lots of teens and adolescents still do read a lot. But a roundup of studies put together by the nonprofit Common Sense Media shows a clear decline over time.
For example, 45% of 17-year-olds today say that they read for pleasure no more than 1 to 2 times a year, if that often.
That's way down from a decade ago, says Jim Steyer, head of Common Sense Media. Among 13-year-olds, a third say they read for pleasure only once or twice a year.
As a parent and an educator, this is a really big deal.
Steyer studies the impact of technology on children, and he finds the results striking, though not shocking. He has 4 kids and has seen the trend, mostly with his 16-year-old.
And I start to see it in our 10-year-old as well, because he is less and less reading. He's more and more attracted to some of the digital media platforms that he has access to and that he did not have access to when he was, say, 6 or 7 years old.
Now, the studies do not say kids are reading less because they're spending more time online. But Steyer's convinced that is at least part of the answer.
First of all, most children now have access to e-readers or other smart electronic devices like phones and tablets, and they're spending time on that. Numerous reports show the increasing use of new technology platforms by kids. It just strikes me as extremely logical that that's a big factor.
I don't really read for pleasure.
I don't read for pleasure either, unless it's for a school assignment.
Jamari Sidnor and Shamaka Anasike are 9th graders waiting for the bus outside Wilson High School in Washington, D.C. So how do they relax?
Generally, I talk on the phone or I watch like Netflix shows or Hulu shows, just like mostly TV, that's it.
I'm usually on my phone or watching TV too.
Of course, some students say they love to read but have too much homework or are swamped with sports. Researchers want to know more about how teens are spending their time in the digital age, but Catherine Zickier of the Pew Research Center says it's tricky. If a kid is looking at a book, you say, they're reading. But looking at a smartphone or tablet? Well, who knows?
And we've heard from middle and high school teachers that sometimes the internet is wonderful for highly motivated students to do deep and expansive research. But on the flip side, obviously, there are many distractions on the internet.
Despite those distractions, Jim Steyer of Common Sense Media says parents can still do a lot to promote reading.
Kids with parents who read, who buy or take books out of the library for their kids, and who then set time aside in their kid's daily schedule for reading, tend to read the most.
Whether it's on a book, an e-book, or some other gadget. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
Our Hidden Kitchen series now reports on the saga of a sous chef who is also a dog. Yeah, we're continuing our season of Hidden Kitchens, our series exploring little-known kitchen rituals and traditions, with a dog that was bred to run in a wheel that turned a roasting spit in medieval kitchens. In 1639, a tourist visiting Bristol, England, remarked that there was scarce a house that hath not a dog to turn the spit. The Kitchen Sisters, producers Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva, bring us this Hidden Kitchens story from England, Turnspit Dogs, the Rise and Fall of the Vernipater Cur.
Since medieval times, the Britons have delighted in eating roast beef, roast pork, roast turkey.
Oh, the roast beef of old England and old English roast beef.
They sneered at the idea of roasting meat in an oven. For a true Briton, the proper way was to spit roast it in front of an open fire using a turnspit dog.
The turnspit was a breed of dog that was once an essential part of every large kitchen in Britain. I'm Kira Farrell, Library and Collections Manager at the Kennel Club in London, 1576. The very first mention of them is in the first book on British dogs ever written.
Turnspit dogs had grey and white fur. They were referred to as the kitchen dog, the cooking dog, or the vernipater cur.
A low-bodied, short-legged,
crooked front legs,
quite a heavy head,
drooping ears,
strong and sturdy, capable of working for hours. Turnspit dogs, they were viewed as kitchen utensils, as pieces of machinery. We have a huge fireplace in an old Georgian kitchen. There is a chain from the spit up to a wheel, and in that wheel is a small dog running frenetically, causing the spit to turn. The roar of the fire, the clanking of the spit, the patter from the little dog's feet. One way of training the dog was to throw a glowing coal into the wheel to make the dog speed up a bit. I'm John Bonderson. My book is Amazing Dogs, a Cabinet of Canine Curiosities.
During the Middle Ages, cooking a meal, large joint of meat, could only be done on a spit, and the lowliest person in the kitchen staff, usually a small boy, turned the spit. Hours and hours, the hands used to blister. During the 16th century, they made the transition from small boys to dogs. Shakespeare mentions them. He describes somebody as being a curtailed dog fit only to run in a wheel. Curtailed means they've got their tails cut off. It was a way that they used to differentiate between the dogs of the nobility and the dogs belonging to ordinary people. These little curtailed dogs were the ones that were put into the wheels.
The dinner must be dished at one. Where's this vexatious turnspit gone? Unless the skulking cur is caught, the sirloin spoiled, and I'm at fault. My name's Lucy Worsley, Chief Curator at Historic Royal Palaces of London. Charles Darwin commented on the dogs as an example of genetic engineering. He said, look at the spit dog. That's an example of how people can breed animals to suit particular needs.
On the Sunday, the turnspit dog often had a day off. The dogs were allowed to come with the family to the church. Not because of any concern for their spiritual education, but because the dogs were useful as foot warmers.
Interestingly, there are also a few records of turnspits being employed in America. Benjamin Franklin's Pennsylvania Gazette had advertisements for turnspit dogs and wheels for sale. A turnspit was active at the State House Inn, Philadelphia.
The State House Inn was where all the old political cronies hung out for their slice of beef and their ale. The owner, in 1745, advertised spit dogs for sale. Evidently, he was also breeding them. I'm William Oyse Weaver, author of several books on food ethnography. In 1702, the wife of William Penn, founder of Pennsylvania, writes to England that she wants a wheel for her turnspit dogs and a butter churn. If they can turn a spit for meat, they can also turn a churn for making butter. In this country, the dogs were basically used turning spit in large establishments in cities, like hotel kitchens. In the 1850s, the founder of the SPCA was appalled by the way the turnspit dogs were treated in the hotels in Manhattan. This bad treatment of dogs eventually led to the founding of the SPCA.
With time, mechanical spit-turning machines called clock jacks, they became cheaper and cheaper as a result of mass production. The clock jacks took over from the turnspit dogs. It became the stigma of poverty to have a turnspit dog. They were ugly little dogs of quite morose disposition, so nobody wanted to keep them as pets. The turnspit dog became extinct.
The George Inn in Wiltshire has a unique spit roast, the only survivor of its type in the country.
Ivan, we're going to do something completely unprecedented here, aren't we?
We're going to turn a spit with a dog in a wheel, which is something I know hasn't been done for about 200 years. Coco, I think we've got to get you into the wheel.
Come on.
There are numerous kitchen dog wheels kept in various museums, but the Abergavenny Museum has the only example of what a turnspit dog really looked like. This dog was named Whiskey.
Whiskey is the last surviving specimen of a turnspit dog, albeit stuffed. My name's Sally Davis, custodian at Abergavenny Museum in Wales. The way she's posed, the taxidermy, I think possibly it was their first go, I don't know.
What kind of dog today is the closest relation to the turnspit dog? Possibly the Queen of England's favourite dog, the Welsh Corgi. The downtrodden, lumpen, proletariat turnspit cooking dogs may well be related to the Queen's pampered royal pooches.
Come on, Coco, you can do it. There we go.
Our story on the turnspit dog was produced by the Kitchen Sisters and mixed by Jim McKee. That's a broadcast term, not a cooking term. You can see a picture of Whiskey at npr.org.